Welcome, viewers and listeners, to another edition of CHP Talks. I'm here with Mr. Stefano Gennarini. Do I say that correctly?
Indeed.
J.D., and he is the Vice President for Legal Studies at the at CFAM, which is a Center for Family and Human Rights. And welcome to the show, and then I'm going to give you a little more detailed introduction.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. So it's really a pleasure. I'm, as I mentioned to you before we hit record, I am in Winnipeg today. I've just come from Halifax, and we will be recording this. I'll be in Manitoba for a couple of days and then on home to British Columbia, those who follow our journeys. But Stefano Gennarini is the Vice President for Legal Studies at the Center for Family and Human Rights, CFAM. He represents CFAM at UN headquarters in New York and researches and writes on international law and policy for CFAM, advising UN delegations and liaising with pro-family organizations around the world. He oversees the Edmund Burke Fellowship. His reports and commentary have appeared on Breitbart, the Congressional Research Quarterly, The Federalist, First Things, the National Catholic Register, and The Stream. He has been interviewed by the New York Times, National Public Radio, Relevant Radio, The Washington Post, and other news outlets. Stefano earned a Juris Doctor from Notre Dame Law School in Indiana in 2011 and was a Blackstone Legal Fellow in 2009. Before attending law school, Stefano trained to be a priest at the Redemptoris House of Formation in London and attended Heythrop College, University of London, where he obtained a Bachelor in Theology. And while in the United Kingdom, he also gained experience in editing and translations with the Catholic Truth Society. And prior to earning his JD from Notre Dame Law School, Stefano lived and worked in the United States, the United Kingdom, Italy, Nigeria, the West Indies, and Israel. He's fluent in Italian and Spanish. Stefano lives in New Jersey with his wife, Elizabeth Marie, and their seven children. He stopped tweeting.
They are eight children now, sorry.
Eight children. It's hard to keep up with the expansion of the family. Wonderful. And I just became a great-grandfather not too long ago. So
congratulations.
Thank you. My bio was not up to date either. Thank you for joining us today. It's tremendous that you are doing the work you're doing with Austin Roos and others at CFAM. So I want to read, before I ask you a few questions, I want to read the mission statement and the vision statement for CFAM. The mission is to defend life and family at international institutions and to publicize the debate. I think that second part may be an important part of what you do. And then the vision is the preservation of international law by discrediting socially radical policies at the UN and other international institutions. So that's quite a mouthful there that you and Austin and others are involved in. When did CFAM start? When did this organization get its start?
CFAM was founded as an institution in 1997. Interestingly enough, the seed money for CFAM was provided from Canadian pro-lifers, which you'll be interested to know.
Wow.
And but it was founded in response to the call of John Paul II, John Paul the Great, we like to say, for Catholics, Christians, and men of goodwill to get involved in the international debates during the 1990s. You may or may not be aware that there were several important UN conferences in the 1990s, beginning in 1992 with the Rio Conference on the Environment, the 1993 Vienna Conference on Human Rights, the 94 Conference on Population and Development, the 95 Conference on Women's Issues. And these were major UN negotiations of agreements with far-reaching policies that would have effects for all governments following the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. There was a, you could say, a feeling that there was a new springtime for international cooperation, if you like. And John Paul II and his collaborators understood that there was a very real threat to life and family, as well as to, you know, the notion of the sovereign state itself in these agreements and in these negotiations, a real effort, if you like, at creating, you know, world government, but also with radically social policies, including promoting abortion, promoting the, you know, moral relativity of any kind of sexual behavior. And John Paul made these calls from the balcony of the Vatican for, you know, everyone to get involved in politics, international politics. And because of those calls, there was always a huge amount of activity around these conferences. And so there was people who would drop, you know, their day jobs, doctors, lawyers, journalists, and they would go to these conferences in Vienna and Cairo and in Rio. But there really wasn't a permanent presence at the United Nations of pro-lifers, of Christians and Catholics who were monitoring the debate and aware of what could be done or not. And therefore, you know, the effectiveness of the pro-life coalition that emerged in those in the 1990s was very limited, because a lot of these agreements and the negotiations had already happened by the time, you know, we were getting involved in the debate. So the nuncio, the papal nuncio, the representative of the Holy Father at the United Nations at the time, Cardinal Martino, he suggested the formation of an organization like CFAM that was necessary. And responding to that call, some Canadians were generous and began and started CFAM. And but the people who were who began CFAM had been involved in these international debates already for a long time. So they had already participated in all the 1990s conferences. And so that's how CFAM started in 1997. And originally, it really was just a fax service for those interested, those, you know, Catholics, Christians, men of goodwill who would come to the UN whenever there were these negotiations, once a year, once every other year. But my boss, Austin Ruse, he would send a fax literally by hand. Right. A Friday fax,
yeah.
On Fridays, sort of informing everyone of what was happening at the United Nations, the negotiations, the new threats to life and family. And that's how it began.
Yeah. So and the UN is just one of the organizations you look at. And I'm going to ask you in a minute about what other world organizations, but a lot of your efforts are focused on the UN. How did they go from being a peace-oriented organization? I mean, I think the foundings of it after World War II and maybe before World War II, the idea was that we got to avoid these world wars at all costs, and the nations should come together and find ways, peaceful ways to live together. How did the UN end up being an institution for advancing abortion and gender confusion and those kinds of things?
Well, that's a very good question, and one that I wish more people were asking. You know, the United Nations was founded as a in an effort to provide a forum for countries to resolve disputes, you know, to promote peace, as well as to promote a common understanding of human rights, as well as economic development. But what happened is that since its founding, there was a multipolar world in terms of ideology, you could say. On the one side, there was the United States. On the other side, there was the communism. There was the the United Nations was sort of like in the middle of this tension. And so the United Nations was very limited in terms of what it could do during the Cold War. During the Cold War, from its founding until the end of the Cold War, the United Nations was always had to toe the line between the two great powers, Russia and the United States. So it could never really seek to impose policies on countries. It could never be a vehicle for world government, because there were two power players promoting radically different visions of human rights, of democracy, of governance. And so the United Nations was kind of like paralyzed in that paradigm. And the only thing that the United Nations could do was promote issues that were of common interest, that were essential, necessary, and generally things on which there was a lot of consensus, humanitarian operations, trying to address hunger, sanitation, basic issues of development.
Right.
What happened with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union was that we moved from a world that was bipolar, where you had Russia on one side and the United States on the other and the United Nations in the middle. We went to one where it was a unipolar world, where the United States and the European Union, the nascent human European Union, were able to essentially co-opt the United Nations as a vehicle for social and economic engineering, or cultural imperialism, if you like. And that's essentially what we have seen happen over the last 30 years, is the United Nations has become a vehicle, and generally it's for progressive political causes. Because conservatives tend to ignore international cooperation. They see the conservative movement, especially in the United States, has been dominated by the law and economics school of thought, which essentially views international cooperation as useless, and international agreements as toothless, as not real law. And this has allowed, therefore, conservatives just don't get involved at the United Nations. I mean, many times we participate every year in dozens of debates, negotiations, and many times we're the only conservative voice in the room. The only conservative pamphlets are coming from us. And there isn't engagement, research, publications, engaging the UN debate on social issues, but also on economic and development issues, which essentially means that there's only one vision for international cooperation, and it's generally a progressive one that undermines sovereignty and also is a threat to life and family.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like the edicts that come out of the United Nations are often antithetical to the things that we value. And I know, like, Denise Montanay, you probably know her name. She's
I've met her on several occasions. Wonderful woman.
Yeah, she's been bringing the pro-life cause there as well, and along with other, I think sometimes there's been some youth contingents from Canada, maybe through Campaign Life Coalition. But how do you interact, like, when you go to the United Nations? How do you get involved in the discussions? You know, it must be challenging, especially if they don't really, you know, many of the movers and shakers may not want your involvement. So how do you press in and have a place at the table?
Well, we have something called ECOSOC status, or we are accredited with the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations, which means we have access to UN premises. We are able to participate in many UN debates in which ECOSOC accredited organizations can participate. So we have that avenue to participate in UN debates, but we also do a lot of contacting delegations on our own. And we sort of, you know, build our contact list and engage diplomats one-on-one during negotiations to sort of have an impact on the actual debates. But yeah, it's hard many ways because we're alone many times, but also because nobody wants to hear what we have to say many times. We're just like, you know, saying something that's very inconvenient or uncomfortable for a lot of people to bring up. And even well-meaning diplomats from countries which we can call traditional, which have shared values, you know, traditional values, even they are many times at a loss on how to engage the UN process, because it is so one-sided. It is all coming from the United States and the European Union, Canada, other Western governments, who are very progressive and promoting only one line of multilateral cooperation. And it's very, very often, if not always, anti-life and anti-family.
Yeah. I find it very strange. Of course, the U.S. Administration right now, of course, and Canada's prime minister and his circle of friends are for whatever reason, have chosen, you know, to support this culture of death in terms of abortion, euthanasia, that type of thing, and this transgender movement now, the LGBT movement in general, but the seems like the transgender aspect of that has poured gas on the thing in the last 5 years, and even the last 2 years more. All of a sudden, everything is about that, transgender rights and the denial of reality in terms of biological realities. And of course, a lot of this goes back to family, parental rights, who do the children belong to? Do they belong to the parents or the state or to God, of course, is the right answer to that. But parents, we believe, as you do, that they have the primary responsibility for the nurture and training and protection of their children, even sometimes from the state. It would be nice if the state and the parents were on the same side, but it seems to be a growing line of hostility between the two, between parents who choose a more traditional view. So in the specific terms of, I don't know what you call UN decisions, they're not exactly legislation in the same sense that laws passed by Canada's parliament or by the U.S. Congress are legislation, but yet they have some bearing on what countries can do. To what extent, I mean, countries have given their loyalty, I guess, to the United Nations, and they will quote from the UN documents as if that, you know, because of this, now we have to do a certain thing. But where's the line between, you know, what's actually law, what's required of participating nations, and what is just a suggestion from the UN, which countries, if they care about their children, they might choose to ignore.
So there's different tiers of UN agreements. You could say there's the most important ones or the most highly normative ones, which are the treaties. These are binding international treaties. They have they are law, essentially. So countries are, when they negotiate and adopt a treaty, they are bound by its provisions. And depending on what kind of constitutional order, they may or may not be directly applicable by courts. But in any case, they do impose an obligation on legislators, governments to abide by them. But those are few and far between international treaties. I mean, there's many, many more than you would think, but they are few and far between compared to UN resolutions. UN resolutions, there's almost 400 UN resolutions that are adopted every year by the General Assembly and the Economic and Social Council, which are the two governing bodies of the United Nations, if you like, and where, you know, all member states have a seat or are able to participate in the decisions of these bodies. And these UN resolutions, they are not binding on states per se, but that does not mean they should not be of concern. First of all, they are binding on the UN system. So there's a common misconception that, you know, these UN resolutions are non-binding, so we shouldn't worry about them. In actual fact, they are binding. They are binding on the UN system. And that's important for two reasons. First, because the UN system administers about $26 billion, $27 billion of international assistance. But more importantly than that, UN resolutions are the standard boilerplate language that goes into all international cooperation agreements, including assistance from the World Bank. The IMF may pick up some verbiage from UN resolutions, but also bilateral agreements where the bulk of the $150 billion, $160 billion of international assistance are doled out through bilateral assistance. So direct aid from Canada to Zambia, for example, or the United States to Kenya or Uganda. All that bilateral assistance very often is also governed by UN resolutions simply because the UN resolutions are sort of the minimum common denominator on which the international cooperation is premised. So UN resolutions do have that programmatic effect. They are also binding on the UN system directly. They have an effect within countries because of bilateral assistance. But they also have a normative value as customary international norms. The idea is that these resolutions are adopted on a yearly or biannual basis. And the idea is that over time, they become crystallized as international norms, as binding international norms under the theory of customary international law. The idea is that if governments behave over time consistently and universally in a certain way with the belief that they are acting under compulsion of law, then a customary international norm can be declared to exist. And this is the theory that abortion advocates are trying to use to impose an obligation to allow abortion on all countries, as well as to redefine the family, to redefine gender, all these things. They are coming, the efforts are under this theory of law called customary international law. So UN resolutions are not insignificant. Moreover, so aside from treaties and UN resolutions, there are also other mechanisms for international cooperation through the United Nations, including human rights bodies that make recommendations to governments, as well as a mechanism called the Universal Periodic Review, where governments can make recommendations to other governments. And all of these can also be used as evidence of a customary norm emerging. So, for example, just this week, about a dozen UN experts, human rights experts, sent a statement to the U.S. government saying that reversing Roe v. Wade, so returning abortion to the states, is a violation of international human rights law, and that the federal government needs to adopt a minimum standard where abortion is legal in the United States. So that declaration, unless it's rebuffed by the United States government, can become evidence of customary international law. Say the Biden administration does not respond to it, or simply says, oh, yeah, sure, we'll do that. Yeah, we'll do our best to allow access to abortion. In actual fact, it's giving authority to these UN experts, and it's creating the impression that there is an international obligation to allow abortion, even though no international treaty allows abortion. And in fact, every time abortion has been proposed as a right in UN negotiations for an international treaty, or even UN negotiations for a non-binding resolution, it has been rejected. So there's a complex, you could say, ecosystem of different levels of normative pronouncements from the United Nations. And the sad thing is, of course, conservatives don't engage the process. Therefore, at all levels, there's generally only one vision for international cooperation, which is very sad because there could be many good things that could be done through international cooperation. So sadly, it's becoming more and more a vehicle for radical policies.
Right. Oh, that's pretty revealing as to what goes on, you know, behind the scenes. As far as I think I get it exactly what you're saying, the normative value or the underlining, emphasizing of certain ways of looking at life, even if they don't have the force of law on states, do carry a force of sort of peer pressure. As peer pressure exists among youth, so these customary international agreements would have an influence on what nation states would choose to enact in law.
You could say even beyond that, and this is especially in the last 10 years, where we have seen progressive governments become even more aggressive. In the last 10 years, we have seen UN resolutions become like a kind of administrative law. We have this, and the confusion that you get legally is similar to the confusion you get about administrative law. So here in the United States, the Congress very frequently adopts legislation without any real normative standards. They simply abdicate their authority to adopt standards and give it to federal agencies that then adopt standards and regulations that are then binding on all the states. And this is called administrative law. And there's always the debate, or how legal is it? In many ways, it's a constitutional crisis because the legislature is not performing its function of representing the people and adopting laws. It's delegating that function to third parties that are unaccountable and unelected. And it's a similar thing that's happening at the international level. You could say there's 400 international regulations that are promulgated every year by the United Nations on a range of subjects, committing governments to certain kinds of policies, adopt them internationally, but also nationally. Mm-hmm. And, depending on what government is in place in each country, they will adopt their national regulations, administrative laws, so that are not even subject to congressional process.
Right.
They will adopt those international standards in their domestic regulations. This is what we're seeing, for example, with the Biden administration on the issue of gender and transgender issues. The standards that the Biden administration is promulgating at a national level are the international standards that sort of began in 1995 at the International Conference on Women in Beijing, the famous conference where Hillary Clinton went there in her pink dress and said, "Women's rights are human rights." I don't know if you recall that one.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a very famous moment. But that conference famously replaced sex with gender in UN documents. Until then, every UN treaty about women, every UN agreement about women spoke of sex, women and men, women and girls, violence against women. Now, everything has been systematic. Since then, progressive governments, particularly the United States and the European Union, but Canada also very prominently, have been replacing every mention of sex with gender. And that's what how we're seeing, you know, the promotion of LGBT issues, as well as the whole transgender ideology throughout every domestic policy. That's the source, these international policies and these international agencies that act as incubators for these ideologies and these policies, waiting for a favorable moment to impose them at the domestic level through the political forces that are in power. And that's just, for example, specifically on the issue of gender, because it's quite illustrative. There's a UN agency called UN Women, the UN Agency for Women. And it now has an almost $1 billion budget, annual budget. And this agency does not provide any kind of traditional programming like education, food, shelter, health, sanitation. It does not provide any of that. The only thing this UN agency does is lobby to promote gender ideology. And it trains politicians, they train activists in every country in the world to promote transgender ideology. Gender beyond the binary, they call it. And that's their mission. And they, you know, maybe in some countries they're not able to push the entire transgender ideology or the whole LGBT agenda, but they will push whatever they can, depending on what the political climate is in each country.
So in Canada, probably in the States as well, it seems like the government, not federal and provincial governments, they will use excuses to push, whether it's euthanasia, abortion, you know, or particularly now with the transgender issues, they will lean on decision. It's convenient for them when the United Nations would make a regulation or a statement about that, because they can then lean on that as an excuse. Well, we're doing it. Or the Supreme Court makes a decision. Well, then the government says, well, we have to do it because of the Supreme Court. But the other thing that they do is they lean on the decisions of municipal bodies, so that the C4, which basically makes it illegal for parents in Canada to counsel their children, even if the child wants to abandon a sexually confused lifestyle, the parents now could be in serious trouble for coaching them in that direction. The pastor of a church could be in trouble for coaching a transgender man who or a homosexual man who wants to return to his biological sex lifestyle. But it seems like there were places like Fort McMurray, Calgary, Lethbridge, and other cities where you wouldn't expect that flavor of approach to these issues would be very popular, and yet they would have city councils would pass similar legislation on a city bylaws on a city level, and then the federal government goes and says, well, it's happening all over the country already, we better put it into law. And that's exactly what happened with C4.
We see that a lot, that the more and more UN agencies are very brazen about the idea of bypassing national governments and going directly to ministries, bypassing state departments, going directly to ministries, municipalities, local politicians, to promote their policies. And it's similar to what they're doing through corporations in the private sector as well, what they call partnerships, public-private partnerships, which are, if you think about it, it's a mess for transparency, because you've got, you know, public interests, private interests converging, no transparency. There's a lot of moral hazards there going on. And there's also another moral hazard, which is what we saw during the COVID pandemic, and I think a lot of people became aware and their eyes were open to this, is the idea that domestic politicians, local politicians, are oftentimes afraid of taking responsibility when their political career is on the line. So, for example, in the context of COVID, everybody simply deferred to the international experts, right, with very few exceptions. You had Ron DeSantis in Florida, Kristi Noem in South Dakota. You had very few exceptions of governors here, exempt in the United States, who felt they had enough independence to act. Right. And the Trump administration, credit to them also, they allowed different states to operate according to the federal constitution to have different approaches to health within their own borders. But more and more, there's efforts. Even now, the Biden administration is working to strengthen international health regulations, give more power and authority to international bureaucrats, constrain the ability of local politicians and governors to craft their own responses to any future pandemic, so that what Ron DeSantis did in Florida or Kristi Noem did in South Dakota could never be replicated in the future. So we're seeing that there's this moral hazard, and we saw it during COVID on health, but it happens on all issues. When we speak to congressional staffers, and it's the same, and I presume in most every government, politicians are generally risk averse, and they will not take an issue unless they know they're going to get a win. And therefore, they're very happy to abdicate their authority to international health experts or experts on any subject, climate experts, anything, as long as they keep their power. And there's a moral hazard there that has to be addressed.
Yes, Stefano, I was wanting to ask about other organizations besides the UN, like the WEF and WHO, but that we maybe don't have time to go too far down those rabbit trails. But you work, your work covers aspects of other organizations besides the UN, right?
We do cover the Organization of American States to a certain extent, but our focus is primarily on the United Nations. We've covered G7 and G20 summits, the European Union, the Council of Europe, different international mechanisms. But our real expertise and field of action is the United Nations primarily.
Yeah. And what would you say is the single most important, if you can put a label on it, issue that directly involves the United Nations right now that you at CFAM are working on, today or these days?
Boy, the single most important, there are so many. Yeah. Probably the most important ones are the ones that the negotiations for binding international instruments. But I don't want to discount non-binding processes also, because they are very significant too. And, there's a danger to discount them. But there's a couple that are really quite important to follow. One is a new pandemic treaty that is being promoted through the World Health Organization, as well as new international health regulations the two are supposed to be complementary. All of the things we saw go wrong during COVID are being adopted as law, as international norms in these pandemic treaties and regulations, including international compliance committees for pandemic preparedness and response, including treaty monitoring bodies to sort of recommend what kind of health system and health policies you need to adopt during regular times, even outside of a pandemic emergency, in order to be prepared for when the pandemic happens, according to what they call this social and economic determinants of health, you know, sort of address all the socioeconomic determinants of health as a way of preparing for the next pandemic. So there's the pandemic preparedness and response process, which we saw also the sort of the totalitarian tendencies in terms of control of information, control of travel, control of freedom of assembly, expression, freedom of religion. All of that is on the line during the pandemic treaty process. Right. And then there's also another treaty that is being discussed, and it's the reason it's worrying is both the United States and the European Union are on board in promoting it, which means, according to that unipolar model, that's going to get adopted. You know, it's very hard for that not to progress. So there's a new treaty on crimes against humanity also that is being proposed. And the new treaty on crimes against humanity would essentially make it a crime against humanity for countries to have laws prohibiting adoption for homosexuals, outlawing homosexual marriage, also on the transgender issue, you know, prohibiting transgender surgeries or transition medicine or whatever you want to call it for teenagers. That could be deemed a crime against humanity, according to the interpretation of the ICC prosecutor of what gender means internationally.
And the opposite, you know, it's such a crime against children to allow and promote these mutilations of their little bodies and their minds. It's not just their body, it's their mental confusion that's being promoted that's so damaging to so many lives. But, I'm very glad that you're doing what you're doing. I'd like to talk more in detail, but I think we've opened the cask, and then maybe we'll come back and have another deeper exploratory discussion of some of these issues. But you've done a great job of explaining the work of CFAM, the Center for Family and Human Rights. And how are you supported? How is your work supported?
So CFAM is supported primarily through small donations. Over 90% of our budget comes from donations that are smaller than $500. So we are a grassroots organization, and we count, and we're very proud of that. You know, at the United Nations, we come up against the government-funded NGOs to the tune of billions of dollars, and we're very proud to not be funded by any one philanthropist, billionaire, or government, but we have real constituents. We're able to say in every UN meeting we go to, we have real constituents. We are a grassroots organization.
So George Soros and Bill Gates aren't among your primary donors?
No. In fact, George Soros and Bill Gates fund organizations that create opposition research reports about us, calling us anti-rights and calling for our expulsion from the United Nations.
Well, you're up against the big guys, but you've got, I believe, God on your side. And that's very important in these days of confusion and social and moral decay. So, I presume that people could find a way of becoming donors on your site, CFAM. Is it what's the site there? CFAM.org?
Yes, C-FAM.org. C-FAM.org. And yes, if your listeners want to come and subscribe to our weekly newsletter called the Friday Facts or donate, we would appreciate that tremendously.
Wonderful. Well, Stefano Generini, thank you very much for joining us today. I know our viewers and listeners will appreciate this information. Thank you for the work you do and the rest of your team at CFAM. And keep it up, and we'll look forward to hearing more and how some of these issues that you're working on, how they play out. But we're so glad that you're there doing that work, that lobbying on our behalf at the UN. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Thanks.